The third case for oral argument this morning is the State of South Dakota versus Michael Cotman. For the appellant, Michael Cotman is John, is it Hendricks? All right, from the office of the Benihana County Public Defender in Sioux Falls. For the State of South Dakota is Ms. Ann Meyer, an Assistant Attorney General. Mr. Hendricks, you may proceed, sir. You have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. I represent Michael Cotman, who's currently serving a 10-year sentence in the South Dakota State Penitentiary for possession of a controlled drug or substance. I appear before the court appealing that conviction on the grounds that the evidence obtained and used against him to obtain that conviction, that evidence was obtained against Mr. Cotman's rights as guaranteed by the Fourth Amendment to the United States Constitution and by the Sixth Amendment of the South Dakota Constitution. On November 16th of 2003, a burglar alarm went off at a Sioux Falls business called Empire Plastics. Sioux Falls police responded to the location, found that there was nobody there, went through the location, and found that a window in an office in the back of the building had been broken. Shortly thereafter, employees from Empire Plastics, specifically Mr. Edwards and a Mr. Swear, arrived. They indicated to police that the only thing that could be found that was missing was a gray locked lockbox that had been contained in a cabinet behind a counter in another office. The police determined that it did not appear that any other items in the business had been rifled through or disturbed, that nothing else had been taken. They also determined that one motion sensor that activated the alarm had been set off by whomever had entered the window and gone into the building. They spoke to Mr. Edwards and Mr. Swear. I think it's notable that these are the only two witnesses that the police interviewed. They spoke to Mr. Edwards and Mr. Swear. They asked Mr. Edwards if he could perhaps list some employees whom he suspected would be responsible. Mr. Edwards indicated the first one who came to mind was my client, Michael Cotman. At the time, Michael Cotman was on parole from a prior burglary charge. He'd been released from the South Dakota State Penitentiary 3 years prior in the year 2000. The police determined that Mr. Edwards had fired Mr. Cotman apparently 5 days before this burglary because Mr. Cotman had not been showing up for work. Mr. Swear also apparently told the police, at least according to the police officer's testimony at the suppression hearing, that he'd heard that Mr. Cotman had been using methamphetamine or that Mr. Cotman had a methamphetamine problem. Based on this knowledge, and with the conspicuous absence of any physical evidence linking Mr. Cotman to the burglary, in the conspicuous absence of any other list of possible suspects, other employees of the business, customers of the business, just other random people who could have driven by the business and broken in and rooted around, or even Mr. Edwards or Mr. Swear, the police focused on Mr. Cotman as their sole suspect. They learned that Mr. Cotman was on parole. They learned that he was on parole for burglary. They tried to contact his parole officer, were unable to do so, but they were able to contact another official from the Board of Pardons and Paroles who confirmed that Mr. Cotman was on parole, and they learned Mr. Cotman's address from that official. The police, without the assistance of any parole officers, went to Mr. Cotman's residence on the other side of town. One police officer went to the back of the house. Two others went to the front door of the house. One of the officers at the front door knocked on the door. The door was answered. According to the testimony at trial of Mr. Cotman's girlfriend, who was also living in the house, the door was answered by their young daughter. According to the police, the door was answered by Mr. Cotman's girlfriend. But in any event, the door was opened. The police, without permission or consent of any kind, walked in, announced that they were there investigating a burglary, not to investigate whether or not Mr. Cotman was complying with his parole, but they were there to investigate a burglary, and they proceeded to search the house. They searched the entire house, including the rooms of the children, including the bedroom of the roommate who was living there at the time, including Mr. Cotman and his girlfriend's bedroom, and all other areas of the house. Ultimately, the police did find a lockbox in one of the basement rooms. It was later revealed that this lockbox had no connection to the burglary, although it was the basis of an initial burglary charge. One of the officers in a basement bedroom also found, rolled up in a shirt, a pipe of the type that the police officer identified as the type commonly used to use methamphetamine. In this pipe, there was what was described later during trial as methamphetamine residue. That was ultimately tested by the state lab in Pierre, came back positive as methamphetamine residue, and based on that, Mr. Cotman was arrested for possession of a controlled drug or substance. Following a suppression hearing that was intended to cover both the burglary charge that was ultimately dismissed and this charge for which we are appearing today, Mr. Cotman was convicted at trial by a jury, and this appeal followed. Mr. Cotman, as I indicated, was on parole at the time of this incident. When he was released in the year 2000, he signed a parole agreement, a standard parole agreement, which according to the testimony and according to the exhibits offered at the suppression hearing, indicated that he and his home and his property would be subject to search and seizure were his parole officer to ascertain the existence of reasonable cause or reasonable suspicion. 2 years later, Mr. Cotman, in lieu of the United States Supreme Court decision in United States versus Knights, a decision which, to the best of my knowledge, has not yet been addressed by this court, Mr. Cotman was called in to meet with his parole officer again and instructed to sign a new parole agreement that added to the original parole agreement and allowed search and seizure were up his parole officer or law enforcement to ascertain the existence of reasonable cause or reasonable suspicion. I bring before the court, and I don't want to, I'm not asking the court to disregard any other arguments I've made in my brief, but for purpose of these arguments, I think that I can synthesize the issues into two. The first is whether or not United States v. Knights applies in the state of South Dakota, or whether, and if it does, whether or not there was in fact reasonable suspicion for the police officers to enter Mr. Cotman's home without a warrant, without consent, and to begin their search. With regard to the first issue, that requires some further explanation. Prior to the decision of the United States Supreme Court in U.S. v. Knights, this court had ruled in South Dakota versus Ashley that law enforcement officers engaged in investigative purposes, criminal justice, law enforcement purposes, cannot merely use somebody's status as a parolee or probationer as an excuse to engage in what would be an otherwise unlawful search or seizure. This is commonly referred to in the case law as the stalking horse doctrine, and it goes back a number of years. In fact, in the case of South Dakota v. Ashley, the court indicated that particular doctrine was well-settled law, and I think that there was a firm policy reason behind referring to it as such. The purpose of United States v. Ashley, although it's not explicitly spelled out, South Dakota v. Ashley and the stalking horse doctrine, although it's not explicitly spelled out, I would suggest to the court is to avoid what I call the usual suspects type of law enforcement. One of my favorite movies is the movie Casablanca, and in that movie, whenever a crime is committed, the police commandant, Captain Renault, will order his men to go out and round up the usual suspects. And the implication in that movie is that they'll go out and they'll just pull out the usual suspects, the ne'er-do-wells and the people that they know, and they'll bring them down to police headquarters and they'll question them, but they won't actually get anything done. They never actually solve the crime. Casablanca is kind of a wild and woolly place and people are allowed to do what they want. I believe that the stalking horse doctrine prohibits police from engaging in this type of behavior. I believe that that it's imperative that the court send a message to the police officers that they should engage in police investigation that's cautious and deliberate and effective and comprehensive, not something that's quick and easy. Go out, who do we know? Oh, he's on parole, he's our suspect, let's go, let's search his house, we'll find something. In this case, this is a situation where the police engaged in that sort of usual suspects, and I don't mean to be flip by using that statement or that analogy, but in this case, this was a situation where the police engaged in that sort of investigation.
Well, they didn't just pick 30 names at random out of Sioux Falls. This person had a specific tie to the place where the burglary had occurred, and the bosses specifically said he's the only one that would have cause to be unhappy with us. Everybody else is left under good circumstances or is still here. That is not a pig in a poke.
You make a very good argument when you say that they did not pick 30 names out of thin air and that they focus solely on one person. But simply because he was the only person who had a reason to be unhappy with the business, for starters, the police didn't know that. They heard that from one person, Mr. Edwards. They hadn't talked to any other employees of the business. They hadn't talked to any other witnesses. They hadn't canvassed the neighborhood, according to their testimony, and talked to any other people who were in the neighborhood who may have been a witness to the crime itself.
That's not required to establish reasonable suspicion.
I agree, but
affidavits, search warrant stops, all kinds of things are decided based on the testimony of just one person. One witness is sufficient, isn't it?
One witness is sufficient if the evidence that one witness provides is sufficient. It's my position that the evidence that Mr. Edwards and Mr. Swear provided was not in and of itself sufficient, even taken in conjunction with the fact that Mr. Cotman was on parole. I don't believe that that was sufficient to outweigh Mr. Cotman's right to privacy and not to have police encroaching in his own home and in his family's home.
So what you're saying is that in order for the police to have this reasonable suspicion, they would have had to have done something more, such as questioning other witnesses.
I believe that's the case, Your Honor. I believe under these circumstances, presented with these facts, it would have been prudent, and I believe it's mandated by their obligation as law enforcement officers, to engage in some further investigation. I'm not going to speculate as to what exactly that investigation should be, but certainly they should have engaged in something more before they were justified in, for lack of a better term, barging into his house and rooting through his family's belongings.
He's a parolee, and so, I mean, as a parolee, he has a very reduced expectation of privacy. What doesn't that affect our analysis?
My argument would be that the state has an interest in law enforcement. And the state has an interest in law enforcement, whether or not the suspect is a parolee or not. There is nothing in the Fourth Amendment.
So you would apply the same standard then to an ordinary citizen that you would apply to the parolees?
If the examination is from the standpoint of the state's interests, then I believe that that should be the case. I do not believe that the state has a greater interest in criminal investigations against parolees and probationers than they do against regular citizens. Again, I think we get back to what I was referring to as the usual suspects sort of investigation, and I believe that the state has an interest in ensuring that law enforcement officers are taking into consideration all the possibilities and reducing the risk that they will focus on somebody such as Mr. Cotton.
Well, the state is taking a chance on a person like this who's already got a burglary when they parole him. Doesn't that allow the state to keep a few strings on him that they don't on John Q. Citizen? Or else maybe they just won't parole anybody.
Absolutely, they are entitled to maintain, as the court refers to it, as strings, Your Honor. But I do not believe that there is a justification for this type of infringement of liberty, a very fundamental liberty interest. And I do not believe that the state's interest in maintaining strings on their parolee is such that they cannot engage in a little bit more comprehensive investigation before pulling those strings. I'm certainly not suggesting that they didn't have the opportunity to locate Mr. Cotman's parole agent, confer with them, collaborate with them to determine the best course of action after conducting some more investigation and obtaining some more evidence.
But doesn't the fact that he is a parolee enter into the factors that a police officer and under reasonable thought process would also factor in all of these other things that were involved?
I'm afraid.
For instance, it's a reasonable suspicion, isn't that correct?
That's
correct. Isn't that the test? And so the police officer we allow the police officer to make the normal inductive kind of reasoning or deductive kind of reasoning based on the totality of the circumstances here. And now he's got all these pieces of information. And also, you know, that Cotman worked there, that he had been fired, that he was the only person that had access or that knew where that was, that they were aware of. Not the only person that knew of it. He did know where it was.
Yes.
He'd recently been fired or left.
Yes.
And also the fact that he is a parolee. Doesn't that almost, I mean, aren't those all kinds of things that the police officer can go through in making a determination on whether there's a reasonable suspicion?
There are certainly criteria that the police officer can take into consideration. I do not believe that those factors in and of themselves amount to reasonable suspicion. And I tried to come up with an analogy in a more familiar setting, because reasonable suspicion is not a concept that we usually come across in this sort of situation. The most common opportunity for an attorney or a judge to discuss reasonable suspicion is when they're discussing whether or not a law enforcement officer is justified in pulling over a vehicle. And the best analogy that I could come up with as I was thinking about this was, if somebody called in and said, there's a drunk driver driving down Highway 12, but they don't describe the vehicle, but they don't describe who's driving the vehicle or provide any identifying information, and the police find out that there's somebody out there named Joe who is on parole or on probation from a prior drunk driving offense, and that he was in that area 5 days ago, and that he uses Highway 12, the police officer would be justified in going over and pulling over Joe the next time the police officer saw Joe based on this situation. And I don't think that that's an exaggeration of the factors here. And I think that that particular analogy places this in a more familiar reasonable suspicion sort of analysis.
Well, certainly, the Knights case settles the question with respect to the United States Supreme Court, United States Constitution. So we're not at liberty to interpret the United States Constitution differently than the United States Supreme Court has.
I agree with the court.
So aren't we bound by Knights then?
I do not believe that this court is bound by Knights on the basis of State versus Opperman, which acknowledges that this court is the foremost authority when it comes to interpreting the South Dakota Constitution. That case also stands for the proposition that this court and the South Dakota Constitution extend more extensive, for lack of a better term, rights than those offered by the Fourth Amendment.
Well, that was an inventory search of an automobile, wasn't it? And this is a case about a parolee who signed an agreement saying, I'm waiving my rights as a private citizen in order to get out of the penitentiary, and I'm agreeing that you can search on reasonable cause. What is it in our Constitution, our South Dakota Constitution, that you say will give these special protections to parolees?
Well, I would cite not the South Dakota Constitution, but I would cite this court's prior precedent in State v. Ashley as well as State v. Opperman for the proposition that U.S. v. Knights doesn't further erode those rights that are guaranteed to parolees. Further, I would cite to the fact that the Sixth Amendment of the South Dakota Constitution itself draws no distinction in its text between parolees and probationers and any other sorts of citizen.
Well, neither does the United States Constitution draw any distinction between parolees and ordinary citizens. But what's so different about South Dakota's Constitution that we should say that our forebears, when they drew that Constitution, had something different in mind than what the forebears who drew the United States Constitution had in mind?
I think that Your Honor's question is answered by State versus Opperman, in which that court indicates that the Sixth Amendment does provide our citizens with more rights than those guaranteed under the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution. And I would rely on that case as my answer.
On a scale of 0 to 10, where would you place reasonable suspicion in contrast to probable cause?
With probable cause being a 10?
Let's say probable cause is 5.1. on more probable than not than on a scale of 0 to 10, where would you place reasonable suspicion?
Reasonable and articulable and individualized suspicion. I'm tempted to answer the court's question by saying that it would depend entirely upon the circumstances of the particular case, and that it would be short-sighted for us to try to apply some numerological. But I don't want to evade the court's question. It would certainly be less than 5.1. It would certainly not be 0 or 1. I would say
2 minutes.
I would say it would be in the neighborhood of 3, perhaps higher. But again,
so it's easier to find reasonable suspicion than it is to find probable cause.
That's correct. But that is not to say that there is no burden behind finding reasonable suspicion.
All right. But under that mathematical equation, you think that this does not even reach a 3 on a point of 0 to 10?
I do not believe that it does, based on this information in and of itself.
Okay. I guess you're entitled to your opinion.
As support for that particular proposition, I would point to the court to the fact that part of its analysis is a balancing test. The state's interest in law enforcement and criminal investigation and engaging in searches and seizures versus the rights of persons to be subjected to reasonable searches and seizures. And that's why I'm reluctant to put it to apply a number, because I believe ultimately it is a balancing test. And I think when the court looks at the information that the law enforcement officers had in these circumstances and they apply it to Mr. Cotman's right to be secure in his own home, in his family's home, against an unreasonable search and seizure, I do not believe that the police had sufficient information available to them to barge into his home and to completely disregard his expectation of privacy in his home. Did they have enough information to go to his house and knock on the door and ask to talk to him? Certainly. Did they have enough information to go to his house and engage in a stakeout? Certainly. Did they have enough information to go to his home and perform a trash pull under the constitutional safeguards that this court and other courts have set up? Certainly. They could certainly have engaged in further investigation, but it was not reasonable based on the paucity of information that they had in this case, the meager amount of evidence that they had on this case, to go to his home, surround it, knock on the door, walk in without permission, and begin rooting through his and his family's belongings. And that is the position that we are taking.
Your time has expired, counsel. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Meyer, you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, when you are on parole in South Dakota, you have a privilege and you are on parole at the sufferance of the citizens in our state. It is a privilege, it's not a right. The key to this search is the fact that this was an inside job. Nothing else was missing. The officers talked to the employer and he told them nobody else was in this area normally in where the box was stored. The foreman told them that there had been this problem with Cotman. He hadn't been showing up for work, that he was a methamphetamine user, and that he had been fired. That wasn't the only thing that these officers looked at. They looked at
evidence. Was there evidence that Cotman knew where the money was kept?
Yes, because he'd been stocking the shelves of this particular place where they normally kept the box with the money in it. That had been something that he'd been doing. He'd also been fired recently, and he'd been a problematic employee.
Judge Severson made the finding that there was a high probability of criminal conduct. Can you address the high probability issue and why you think these facts fit into the high probability?
Well, when Supreme Court Justice Rehnquist was writing Knights, he talks about the high probability and reasonable suspicion, and that means probabilities. You're looking at the probabilities that it's this person. It's still a lower standard. Reasonable suspicion is still below probable cause. But what probabilities are you looking at that tells you that it's this person? And I don't think this is like Casablanca at all. Cotman hadn't had any prior since 1992. It had been 11 years since he had any theft problems. Now, he is a career criminal. He's had a lot of theft and burglary problems, but he wasn't on the radar screen as far as a non-usual suspect or anything like that.
He wasn't on the radar screen because of his prior criminal conduct as much as he was for his conduct at the place of business, right?
Yes, thank you, Justice Savers. That's what we're saying, yeah. He didn't have any pre-existing reason why the cops would be focusing on him or why the police would be looking for him.
Let me ask about reasonable suspicion. It's not defined in the Knights case. And what is it? We don't have a definition of it in South Dakota as pertains to searching parolees' homes. What kind of a definition would you use? Would you borrow it from the articulable suspicion cases and automobile cases or from somewhere else?
Probably borrow it from the kind of searches that we've seen or type of situation we've seen with vehicle stops, a specific articulable facts, something that would lead you to believe that this is the person who's involved in that particular criminal activity. And that's what these officers had here. It's an inside job. They knew it was him, and they went and to follow up on their search, they checked his criminal history. That would also be a factor, but not something like Casablanca where they're looking for him. But certainly the standard of specific reasonable facts, which is what they had here. And the stock, I want to follow up on this point that defense counsel made about the stalking horse. This court looked at that 15 years ago, but since the Ashley decision, Knights has come down and the stalking horse doctrine has been eliminated. That's no longer the standard. We're using the reasonable suspicion standard, not the stalking horse.
Is there a difference, though? Usually when we're invited to provide greater rights, it's greater than we've recognized before or the U.S. Supreme Court. Here he's simply asking us to stay the course.
In terms of adopting Knights, we're asking you to stay the course?
Yes. Is there a difference?
We are asking you to stay the course because a parolee has, in terms of adopting the federal law,
if we stay the course under our previous case.
No, not staying the course under Ashley. I'm sorry, I misunderstood. No, to stay the course under Knights is what I'm saying.
Well, we've never recognized Knights.
Well, this is the time to recognize it.
That's not staying the course.
Well, I guess I disagree. If it's a new, what we're saying, then maybe we do agree, because you would have to revise what you've been looking at before, which is the stalking horse doctrine. So in terms of federal constitutional law, this court would try to meet that level, which was what I was referring to as staying the course. And there wouldn't be a reason to go with the stalking horse doctrine, because that's no longer a valid analysis. The reasonable suspicion test is...
But we could go with a different standard than reasonable suspicion. We could require a higher level of knowledge on the law enforcement side of it and require something more than reasonable suspicion.
You could, but you'd have to ask yourself why you'd do that in this context, because with parolees, there's a higher risk of recidivism that we see in the case law, and they're also being monitored. It's for their protection and for the protection of the public. It's to make sure that you're going to reacclimate into the community, and also that we can protect the citizens of South Dakota from this type of situation, where you have somebody who's really still in custody and has been released as a privilege.
They never did find the cash at Mr. Cotman's home, did they?
No, they never found the cash. They did find the cash box and a crowbar and a shard of glass in his clothes, but they did not find the cash. Instead, what they did find was the methamphetamine pipe that was wrapped up in the shirt in the bedroom that he was sharing with his girlfriend.
They found the cash box from the place of business?
Yes. Well, no, because the reason the burglary was dismissed, and counsel touched upon that, my understanding from talking to the prosecutors is that the victim could not recognize the box, that the cash box was a standard box, and could not be sure that that was their box. So we dismissed the burglary charges.
Was there any information in the record that this was kind of a modus operandi of Mr. Cotman in his prior burglaries?
Yes, excuse me. That's true. He had five priors, two burglaries in Minnehaha County, two in Brookings, one theft charge in 1992. All of them were kind of a burglary spree. That is a factor that some state courts have been looking at. It is kind of like a modus operandi type of analysis, and it was another factor. When they checked his criminal background from the patrol car, that did enter into the equation as to why they were searching his home and going to his home to see.
And they were aware of that at the time?
They were aware of it. Yes, before they performed the search, before the search commenced.
So they, besides the, I forget the man's name at the business, besides the information from the person at the business that they suspected Cotman, what other information did the officers have then? You're just saying they did have his prior burglaries. Anything else that they knew?
They talked to the employer, the person who unlocked the building for him so they could check the building. They talked to the foreman. They also checked the layout of the building with these motion sensor alarms. Only one thing was taken. Nothing else was disturbed. Whoever did this, they had this. They were inside the building, knew how to get in and get out fast. They looked at the criminal history as far as the search, and then also talked to another parole agent, not the assigned parole agent for Cotman, but talked to another one who was in the same system. Those are the factors that make up the reasonable suspicion in this case. And we disagree with the defense. We think there is reasonable suspicion. And also that the stalking horse doctrine is no longer a viable one for this court to adopt. In terms of Opperman, The same kinds of concerns exist because there is really no reason why the citizens of South Dakota would expect or want more protection in this context. The problem with a parolee is that we're watching their conduct and we're watching for recidivism, and this public needs that kind of protection. So that's pretty much our argument in a nutshell, and if the court has any further questions.
Okay.
We've covered it. All right, thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Okay, Mr. Henritz, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you. I'd like to address first a few of the answers that Ms. Meyer gave to your questions. Justice Meyer Henry, you asked whether or not there's any information on the record regarding modus operandi. Ms. Meyer indicated that the prior convictions had occurred a number of years prior, which, by the way, I believe goes to undermine the state's argument that this somehow bolsters their argument of reasonable suspicion that he had priors. The priors were, after all, several years before. There was nothing on the record no information available to the police officers at the scene that they testified to later that would indicate that this was the type of burglary that Mr. Cotman had engaged in before. With regards to what was found,
all they had was his rap sheet, I suppose, that he had been convicted of burglaries and when they were.
I do not believe, if memory serves me correctly, I do not believe that the officer testified even to that. My recollection is, and I would invite the court to double check me against the record, but my recollection is the officer testified only that they knew he was on parole from prior burglaries. With regards to what was found in the house, this is anecdotal in nature, but to satisfy the court's curiosity, the reason that I was given for the trial prosecutor for dismissing the case was because the key that Mr. Edwards produced for his lockbox did not fit the one found in Mr. Cotman's home. The only other items that they found, according to the record, were a crowbar in a vehicle parked in front of the home and some broken glass in a basement. And I do believe that it speaks volumes, and it is a matter of the record, that the burglary charge was ultimately dismissed by the prosecutor.
But that doesn't have any constitutional significance in deciding whether or not there was reasonable suspicion at the outset, because we don't look at, after the fact, what you actually find or what's proven.
I agree.
The question is what's available at the time of the search.
I agree, Your Honor, and I don't offer it as evidence that there wasn't reasonable suspicion. I offer it as an illustration of what the state's interest really is in this case, and that's the effective law enforcement and effective criminal investigation. And this is a situation where that did not occur because they did not have reasonable suspicion, and as a result, whoever it was who broke into that building was never arrested and prosecuted, apparently. Addressing the issue of whether or not this court should overrule South Dakota v. Ashley, whether or not State versus Opperman provides the court with some incentive to stay the course, as Chief Justice puts it, I would argue that the state has not demonstrated that adopting U.S. v. Knights in any way furthers the state's interest in a matter better than what than South Dakota v. Ashley does. When this court decided South Dakota v. Ashley, they stated the aforementioned principles, in short, the stalking horse doctrine, are based upon sound reasoning and are well established. There has been nothing cited by the state to indicate that that's not still the case. Furthermore, there's been nothing cited by the state that should persuade the court that adopting South Dakota v. Ashley, or that adopting U.S. v. Knights, will more effectively further the interests of the state. If the interests of the state were not furthered by South Dakota v. Ashley, I do not believe that this court would have condoned it in South Dakota v. Ashley.
But Ashley was decided solely on the grounds of the Fourth Amendment to the United States Constitution. And the Supreme Court of the United States has changed the interpretation of that provision. So how can Ashley still stand?
Because I still believe that the South Dakota's Sixth Amendment to the Constitution, pursuant to State v. Opperman, provides a higher level of protection for all of our citizens than the United States Supreme Court has acknowledged that the Fourth Amendment does.
You know, I have to concede that Opperman does say what you say it says. You know, Opperman was decided 30 years ago at a time when several state courts were beginning to adopt a new doctrine. And since Opperman, most state Supreme Courts now require, I mean, since that time, most state Supreme Courts are saying it's not enough just to say we should take our state constitution and say it's different from the federal constitution and it grants more rights. The attorney arguing that point has the burden of coming forward with principles and facts to show how the state constitution is different and why it should be interpreted differently. And you haven't shown how it's different. You argue Opperman, and I have to concede Opperman just says it's different, but that's a day that's passed. Now I think lawyers have to show why it is different. And what do you have to say about that?
I cannot tell you what it is about the Sixth Amendment to the Constitution without getting into a long discussion of federalism and states' rights versus federal rights and what both constitutions have to say about the rights of citizens with respect to
the government. Well, that's what briefs are for. I mean, isn't that what, that's why long discussions about legal principles is the definition of a brief.
And I will concede that that issue wasn't briefed, and perhaps it wasn't briefed to the court's satisfaction. But I would still argue, contrary to that, that before the court deviates from South Dakota v. Ashley, they should place the same burden on the state to indicate why that is no longer good law in the state of South Dakota, why that no longer effectively furthers the state's interests. And I don't believe that that has been done in this case.
It seems to me that the state's best argument is that only one thing was stolen, only one thing was moved or taken or approached, only the cash box, and that convinced them that was an inside job, and that this one person, you know, knew where the cash box was because he had worked in that stock room or wherever. What do you have to say that that's not enough for reasonable suspicion?
Somebody set off a motion alarm. The police officer's position and the state's position relies on the assumption that this was an inside job and therefore Mr. Cotton was the likeliest suspect. And in part, they come to that conclusion because whoever had come in didn't set off any of the other alarms, but somebody set off one of them, and that would seem to undermine their argument with respect to that. Furthermore, I do not believe that the facts that the state relies on to think that Mr. Cotton was the one responsible for this make Mr. Cotman the exclusive suspect or even a suspect worthy of extra attention to the exclusion of any other suspect, again, including Mr. Edwards and Mr. Swear themselves. Mr. Swear's description of the lockbox that was taken was vague. Mr. Edwards' description of the lockbox that was taken was vague. Certainly, since it was his lockbox and it's his business, I would feel, if I were a law enforcement officer, that that's something that would trigger some suspicion in the back of my mind. They didn't investigate, according to the transcript of the suppression hearing, they didn't investigate any other possibilities, any other employees, only the name that they were given. My argument is that you have to look when determining whether or not there's reasonable suspicion in this case, and again, I'm not...
You have 2 minutes.
Thank you. I'm not conceding that in and of itself should be the standard, but for argument's sake, I believe that you have to look as much at what law enforcement knew as what they didn't know because they didn't take the time or bother to find out. And again, I go back to my analogy. I do not believe that this court would ever condone a law enforcement officer pulling over a car because somebody had called in and reported that somebody was driving drunk on this stretch of highway, and the law enforcement officer knows that this guy had driven drunk sometime in the past and just happens to be in the area without some further information available to them. I'd also like to address Justice Saber's question to Ms. Meyer about whether or not Mr. Cotman was a suspect or on the radar screen because of the evidence that the police had with regard to this burglary and what connection that had to his parole status. I think it's clear from the transcript from the suppression hearing that they didn't make the decision to go to his house until they found out that he was on parole. They had certainly had him in mind as a suspect, but it was when they found out that he was on parole that they made the decision. It certainly weighed a great deal in their in their decision making to make Mr. Cotman the primary suspect in this case. By doing that, I think that they further undermine the argument that what happened, the evidence available to them at the scene, was sufficient in and of itself. And again, I do not believe that the two of them put together, even when added up, the sum total amounts to reasonable suspicion that justifies an intrusion on Mr. Cotman's right to not have unreasonable searches and seizures take place inside his very own home. Again, I would ask the court to consider the arguments made by myself in my brief. Nothing that I've said here is intended in any way to waive any of those arguments. And on behalf of Mr. Cotman, I appreciate the opportunity to represent him in front of the court.
Thank you, counsel. The court will be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock.